Today's episode of the DTFH with legend Mark Maron is brought to you by Squarespace.com. Go to Squarespace and enter an offer code Duncan to get 10% off a brand new website. Oh, yes. Just got back from a 5-mile run, and I feel like Genghis Khan riding away from a burning village filled with the ravaged, smoldering corpses of his vanquished foes. You know me, I'm a big fan of all kinds of drugs, but as far as drugs go, particularly the opiates, I can think of no high better than that created by the natural pharmacy existing in your brain. And when you go running, for whatever reason, the pharmacist up there decides to start dispensing to you sweet, beautiful endorphins. And God damn it, it's incredible. It's amazing. It's amazing. Endorphins are the one drug, as far as I'm aware, that are not obtainable with dough. You cannot buy natural sweet endorphins. As far as I'm aware, maybe you can buy injectable endorphins, but it's not your endorphins. It's not the endorphins that were whipped up in the synapses and the synaptic vesicles of your brain. Somebody else's synthetic fucking endorphins. It's the difference between a perfumery's version of flowers, of roses, and the actual smell of a rose. You've got it up there, and all these little bubbles in your brain, these synaptic vesicles have stored up. I don't know where they're stored, actually. I just like the term synaptic vesicle. Just read it because I was looking up why I was depressed from taking MDMA and found out that your serotonin is stored in these little joy bubbles in your brain called synaptic vesicles. And that MDMA goes rampaging through your brain, squeezing the happy juice out of these synaptic vesicles. And that creates the embarrassing conversations you probably have had with someone you didn't even know when you told them that you love them at a music festival. Well, the problem with that is that shit gets squeezed out into your brain. And then because your brain is like a very efficient factory, it notices that it has way too much serotonin in stock, and it decides not to make it anymore. So all the serotonin that is floating and fluttering through your brain gets reabsorbed, and your body doesn't produce that stuff, maybe for as long as 3 weeks, and this creates the awful state known as Terrible Tuesdays, which so many clubbers have complained about, which is that a few days after, usually after you've taken MDMA on a Saturday, right around Tuesday, you begin to get the neurological equivalent of being fisted minus the lubricant, because serotonin is the lubricant that the universe likes to use as it slowly fucks you to death. When that stuff's gone, it don't feel great. That's depression. You know, you've heard about these SSRIs, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which basically shut the drains in your mind so that all that serotonin doesn't go swirling back into your body and you sort of begin to store it up. And this allows you to feel okay. And people who are terribly depressed will use those things. Probably some of you guys out there listening are taking those things. But man, running. I don't know I need to look it up. I don't understand the biomechanics behind whatever is being secreted into my bloodstream whenever I run 5 miles. But I've heard the term endorphin. It sounds like morphine. So they're probably somehow related. But wow, it is the most incredible feeling. And it's incredible on a lot of different levels. Because if you're like me, you're not one of these people who came blasting out of their mother's vagina like an Ethiopian marathon runner crossing the finish line. You're not one of these people who have countless trophy rooms and pictures of them throughout their entire lives with their shirt off. You're somebody who, when you were a kid, you wore your shirt when you went in the swimming pool. You're somebody who continues to wear your shirt when you have sex, if you're like me. And you know what that's like. You know that you just have to resign yourself to a constant undertone of feeling a little dissatisfied with the way your physical body looks, and it fucking sucks. So anyway, I'm about 4 months into an experiment to see if I can do the most cliche shit that you hear about on late night TV all the time. I'm trying to do it. I want to see if I can create the big transformation in my body. I'm not going to talk about it any more than I already have. I feel like I'm going to become self-congratulatory or even more didactic than I already am being, but I just want to say that I'm having some success And because of this success, it seems like that sweet Santa Claus pharmacist existing in the neurological workshop in my brain is giving me the gift of some powerful endorphins that are really keeping me motivated. And it's pretty fucking awesome. So you've heard me say it before. If you're somebody out there right now who is like me, stuck in the gravity well of your couch or your bed or your whatever the fuck it is, and you want to get high and you don't have access to any narcotics, or you'd rather get high on the sweet, natural, beautiful endorphins produced by your brain because you're sick of being constipated and addicted, then all you got to do is peel yourself off of your couch, put on some running shoes, and go running. Just try it. I'm not guaranteeing it's going to work. Maybe it won't work the first time. But if you run a little bit further than you think you can, don't try to run really fast either. Do a lope. Family style comedian. Don't try to do it fast. Just do it. Run, friends, run. Run from the Bill Cosby of your entropy. Run from the addictive patterns that have been drugging you and trapping you in a sedated, awful state. I'm telling you, if you want a quick, easy, badass high, and I'm sure some of you already know this happens, but for those of you who don't, all you got to do is go for a run. It's like writing a prescription to the pharmacy in your brain for a bottle of God's Vicodin. All right, pals, we have got a great podcast for you today. Holy shit, it's fucking Marc Maron. This guy is a podcaster who managed to land, apparently it's the second interview, I don't care, I'm calling it the first interview, even though that's not true, with the president of the United States, and that's fucking wild. This guy sat down with Barack Obama. You can listen to that podcast, that interview, by going to WTF, that's Maron's podcast. Listen to it before this interview, because we talk about it a little bit. We talk about it a lot. I love Maron. He's done, if you want to reduce podcasting by calling it a fucking industry, he's done a lot for this industry. And believe it or not, he's the guy who, I don't know why you wouldn't believe it, he's the guy who, when I was doing a podcast with Natasha Leggero called The Lavender Hour, he's the guy who told us to use Libsyn, which is currently the server that we use and I've been using for years. It's that guy. He's the guy. He gave us the technical details that we needed to pull this shit off. So, and he's done that for a lot of people, I'm sure. Really, really, really happy to have him on the show. We're going to dive right into that interview, but first, some quick business. This episode of the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is brought to you by the sweet web mages over at squarespace.com. 90% of them are lawful good, 5% lawful neutral, and the other 5% are true neutral. But there's no evil over there at Squarespace because they have created a magical way of getting your business, blog, or art on the internet so that it doesn't look like shit. Did you know that when William Blake said, "Oh, Rose, thou art sick," he was talking about a person without a website? How do you not have a website? Are you some kind of Unabomber? Did you just finish dismembering a toddler? Are you currently wiring together a mail bomb that you intend to send to a senator or a priest? What has happened to you? What kind of dark demon has clawed its way into your ear holes and has taken up residence in your brain that you haven't made the conscious decision to sling your entrepreneurial bobber out into the great digital waters of the World Wide Web and fish for glory, friends? Sure, maybe you're not going to catch anything, but a lot of trolls, some embarrassment, or even worse, the sense of being completely ignored by your species, but at least you made the fucking effort. And to quote a meme that I just read on Reddit, there is no worse failure than knowing you could have tried harder. You know what? You could have tried harder. If you're somebody who knits or does any kind of art, and somehow you haven't managed to surmount your own insecurities and just get your shit out there to see if you could plug into the demonic machine of capitalism and get the sweet green nipples of Satan to start spraying some rectangular bits of power into your bank account, then it's time you did it. It's a very low-risk endeavor, too, thanks to Squarespace. It used to be a high-risk endeavor. It used to be that if you wanted a website, you had to go down to the website district in downtown Los Angeles, and the odds were really good that some awful fucking thing would happen to you. You were going to get stuck with a nefarious web designer. These bastards will do whatever it takes to not only steal your money, but to give in return a shit product. And how do I know this? I know it because I was one. I did it. I was desperate and broke. I convinced myself that I had some kind of web editing skill just because I'd figured out how to cut and paste. I threw my shit up on Craigslist, and I'm ashamed to say I designed a couple of websites that look like electronic diarrhea. And I took money for it. And it's something I think about all the time. You know what? I feel like I need to make amends, probably, to some of those people. Well, maybe I'll do that. Maybe I'll do that. The point is this. There are great web designers out there. They do exist. But like any other craftsperson, like any other skilled technician, they charge shit tons of money because they had to get addicted to Adderall, which they snorted year after year after year as they slowly went insane learning how to code. These are people who have stared into the digital Necronomicon so they could help you manifest your dreams, and that's why they charge a lot of money. So, if you don't have a ton of cash to blow on a web designer, you want to create a beautiful-looking, professional-level website, you can go to squarespace.com. They will help you create a beautiful website for only $8 a month. Sign up for a year. You get a free domain name. They've got 24/7 customer support, which I've tested out. It's great. They've got a responsive design. And every website comes with a free online store, which means you can immediately start doing e-commerce. Use offer code Duncan. You're going to get 10% off at checkout. Squarespace. Start here. Go anywhere. I wouldn't lead you astray. If you're thinking about building a website, use Squarespace. They've supported us for a long time, and I hope you'll support them. We're also brought to you by Amazon.com. If you're going to buy anything before you head out to some plague-filled store, most stores these days are either filled with surveillance devices or quantum mist that gets into your skin and is used by the government to track everything you do. It detects your thought patterns and will send the police to your house if you're thinking about doing anything wrong. So there's no point in leaving your house. The microwave beams out there are going to fuck up your chakra system. Just stay at home. It's safe. You are a rock. You are an island. And a rock feels no pain, and an island never cries. And an island uses Amazon.com because it doesn't want to go out in the world and breed the pheromones of strangers and get forced to deal with the awful realization that every single person on planet Earth also thinks they're the center of the universe. Support your narcissism. Go to Amazon.com if you're going to buy anything. And I'll tell you what I'm really into right now, and it's probably one of many signs that I'm in the midst of a fantastic midlife crisis, is that I love these Hue lights. Hue lights. They're these color-changing lights that you can connect to your phone. I now have them all over my house, and it's super cool. I'm sorry, but it just is. I've got the strip lights. I've got the bloom lights. It's all over my podcast studio. I like it. I don't want to be chained by some boring old crap bulb that all of human history has been using up to this point. I want to be able to turn my room. I have an app that is at this very moment changing the light patterns in this podcast studio so it feels like I'm in a forest. It's cool. I love it. You can get those at Amazon.com. And if you go through our portal located at DuncanTrussell.com in the comments section of any of these episodes, they give us a small percentage of anything you buy. You don't have to pay any extra. So it's a way to support this podcast while supporting yourself. You can also support the podcast by going to our shop located at DuncanTrussell.com. Pick up some mugs, a poster, a t-shirt, or don't do anything at all. The number one support I would like from you guys is love beams coming from wherever you happen to be sitting, radiating directly out to the people closest to you. And then the second form of support I'd like is if you buy some goddamn shirts. Do it! Show the people around you that you listen to this podcast, and you might just draw into your life some mythological sweetheart who's going to make you have orgasms until you suck backwards into a singularity and implode into an alternate universe of joy. Today's guest is a true hero of podcasting. Not only did he just interview President Barack Obama, but he's also interviewed a lot of other amazing guests, and he's an incredible interviewer, a brilliant comedian, and he's got a great show on IFC. Everybody, please welcome to the DuncanTrussell Family Hour Podcast, Mark Maron. I didn't steal it from you, Mark, but I do think it takes balls to do an opening monologue. A lot of people don't have the guts to do that.
Is that true?
Yeah, I think people are afraid. It makes you feel crazy. You feel narcissistic.
Do you?
A little bit.
Yeah. You got to learn how to talk into the air.
Exactly. And you got to feel like you have something that's worth saying enough to upload.
Yeah, I don't always abide by that. Sometimes you just say things.
Yeah, you're right. And you just upload it and you try not to think about it, right?
Just put it out there into the air. See what comes out of your head, out of your face. I'm trying to adjust to this, the new Duncan with the Equinox hat.
I've been made fun of, by the way, getting so made fun of for this Equinox hat.
Where?
My girlfriend.
Yeah?
Relentlessly makes fun of me for the Equinox
hat. It starts with a hat like that.
And then where does it end?
I don't know. You lose something. Something gets lost.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And that's your fat, Maron. That's what gets lost. You lose your fat, and you're right.
But you're all in, man. This is heavy.
I'm committed.
You know what's great about this type of thing that you're going through?
What?
Generally, it doesn't last. Then what'll happen is you'll feel good. You'll feel great.
Yes.
And then you'll be like, look at my body. It's fucking amazing.
Yes.
And then you'll be like, I think I can have a couple beers. And then, you'll wake up just slightly hungover, and you'll be like, "I'm just gonna go tomorrow.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go tomorrow.
Yeah,
I'm gonna cancel my trainer thing because I kind of want to eat some at that place. I'm gonna cancel the trainer tomorrow.
Yeah. I know what you're saying, man. I mean, you're talking about the demon. Like, you're talking about the demon of entropy. It's haunted me my entire life. The cycle of building something up, and then finally when you get it to some certain place, the demon comes.
Yeah.
And then you either immediately destroy the thing or you slowly devolve back into what you were. I know exactly.
Right. Well, I mean, but maybe you're actually instead of devolving, perhaps you weren't evolving at all, and maybe you're just returning
to your true form.
To your personal truth, which is entropy.
Well, that's actually, it's not just entropy. What you just described is what I consider to be the spiritual wave. Uh-huh. It's the spiritual waveform. Mm-hmm. And that is you experience this. Like, a lot of people think that the failure, which would be to achieve something and then to go back to what you call your true form, that's somehow failure, but that's failing to identify the peak that you reach too. And this gets described as floating in the ocean. Sometimes you see the land, sometimes you don't. But when you're not seeing the land, it doesn't mean that the land's not there, and it doesn't mean that your life sucks or that you have no willpower. It just means that you're in a trough, you know?
Maybe. It also could mean that you just have a propensity for beating the shit out of yourself in two different ways.
You do, right?
You use words like entropy demon. We can use a lot of semantic descriptions for a lot of the same shit. But I'm saying that generally speaking, and don't get defensive.
I don't feel defensive at all.
Oh, good. I'm saying generally speaking that you're either going to push yourself to succeed in this way that has tangible results that seem healthy. That they may be very well be healthy.
Yeah.
And but then, like, if you don't do that, you're like, fuck, I didn't do it. Why didn't I fucking do it?
Right.
Then if you let it all go, then you just back into, like, I'm a fucking idiot. Why can't I fucking, fuck it. So, like, at least you're doing something when you're saying fuck it.
Well, right. Yeah, but it's all you have to remove from what you just described is the beating yourself up part.
Right.
If you start learning how to not beat yourself up so that...
I am, actually. I feel better about, like, I'm a little easier on myself, man.
I think that's the only – that's what, if you really want to talk about where the failure is happening, it's definitely just the
– beating yourself up.
Yeah.
Judging yourself too harshly.
Yeah. It's that narrative where when you're doing some great –
Hey, man, I think that you can rationalize anything, and I'm all for it.
I think you have to rationalize everything. You know, that's kind of the way it works.
Sure. Where does – but then you have to you should have some moral compass.
Well,
with rationalizing, there should be a point where you're like, I think I really did something wrong.
Yeah, right. And then how long? The question is, when you get to that point, like, I did something wrong, whatever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how long do you sentence yourself to lamenting your fuck up?
Well, that's back to the self-hatred thing. It's all relative, you know, but how do you... How do you take responsibility for that fuck up? I guess it depends on the depth, you know what I mean? If you're standing over a body, you got a lot more work to do than if you just, you know, like, threw up in your car.
Well, this is, you know, this thing you're talking about is a real, I interviewed this Buddhist teacher, Jack Kornfield, and I asked him something along the lines of, like, when is this just denial? Like, when are you just the whole forgiving yourself or loving yourself? When does it just become, like, basic, flat-out denial? Like, when are you supposed to go into Nathaniel Hawthorne mode, scourge yourself for whatever the great crime it is that you committed, instead of going into, like, well, I love you. Mm-hmm. I love you, Duncan, no matter what you've done. Oh, I know that you were drunk and you ran over that kid, but I love you.
And prison's not bad.
Yeah, right.
Let's put another day mark up.
Yeah, that's it. That's a real fucking that's a real problem with spirituality or Buddhism. And that's why a lot of people accuse spiritual people or Buddhists of being passive. They say that it's a kind of nihilism or a spiritual way to become completely passive in your life. Instead,
there's a saying that sort of resurfaced in my life because it was on a t-shirt years ago, and it was designed by a guy named Don Rock out of Austin. He's in Austin, but he was in New York years ago, and he did a lot of wild ass shit. He did this series of shirts called the ABCs of Terror. This is before terror. This is more, it was a general terror. The terror had not been defined as such.
Right.
So he doesn't do those shirts anymore. But like N for narcotic was, there was this wild silk screen of a TV. You know, like it was like heady shit, you know, like anarchist shit. But he had this shirt that I never had the balls to wear, but I'm just always hung up on it. And it just had the earth on it. And it said, fuck the world, save yourself.
Yeah.
So now... how this ties into what you're saying is that it seems to me that the internet serves one primary purpose for most people, and that's to cherry pick their reality, including their ideology and what they want to associate.
Yeah.
So you have this sort of freedom to decide, you know, what reality you want to live in, despite whatever reality is real, and I don't want to do that thing. But what I think is that in relation to spirituality or people judging spirituality, it's like you're going to have to find the balls to get off the grid somehow.
Yeah.
Right? You know, either mentally or for real. Because, like, all I'm thinking about these days, really, is, like, when do I get to stop?
Right.
And it's like, what? Is that some sort of vision in my head? Is it bullshit? Like, you know, I said to my friend Dave, I said, you know, I just want out. He goes, what are you going with? I said, cabin, not suicide.
That's a great shirt.
Go with the cabin one.
You kind of have the Ted Kaczynski fantasy. You've got the fantasy.
No, just like I think my fantasy is like I think that idea, and I've played with that idea for a long time. I mean, I used to do a bit about like that fantasy. You know, where you're just at the cabin, you got a little land, maybe you get a goat, or a couple of chickens, and then the joke was, all right, tell me about day three.
Yeah.
So is it a real fantasy? Do I have a manifesto to write? Am I angry at society? No. But is it some place in my brain where I can find some like hope or relaxation or the idea of it that I could? Because as I get older and I accomplish more things and I feel better about myself, I have to really sort of try to understand, well, what do these accomplishments mean? Where do they end? What do I really want? Like, I don't know that I've ever asked myself those questions. All right. So now you're okay. You know, I got a few bucks saved. Yeah, I'm relatively healthy.
Yeah.
And what do I really want to do? I mean, I'm driving a fucked up Camry. Why? I don't know. I don't know. Why don't I just buy a new car? Because it makes me anxious. I don't know which one to get, and I'll probably get the wrong one. And why don't I get a new house? Why? Why? And I have two bedrooms. I don't even know what to do with the second bedroom. So what do I really want?
This is, to me, one of the most striking parts of your interview with Obama was when he said to you, you're big time now, Mark. You're big time now. You can't do this anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, he identified, having only met you for a few moments, he identified that you appear to be existing according to a paradigm that you're no longer in, and which would be one where you're not, where you're still living maybe as somebody who's like not the Mark Maron of today, which is the first podcaster to interview the first black president in American history. You made history. You made for this industry, which is a brand new industry.
I think Bill Simmons interviewed him about basketball for 10 minutes.
Okay, well, there's always some. What I mean. Like, you got the real thing.
I got a sit-down hour.
Yeah, man.
And with a sitting president.
Yeah, with a sitting president. You have your own TV show. You are someone who has become, as far as the particular industry that you're in, at the very crest of the wave of success.
Yeah.
And you still are haunted, it sounds like, a little bit, by this fear of expanding into a bigger version of yourself.
Maybe. I don't know what that looks like, though. I mean, because that paradigm you're talking about is relative to what we judge as the signifiers of what? Status? I mean, is my inner life not expanding? I think it is.
Right.
Is my sense of self in a different place? Yes.
Yeah.
Do I experience more confidence and do I feel like I'm pretty good at my job? Yeah. But I mean, I think he was maybe commenting in some, you have to sort of parse politicians in a way. I mean, like, I don't know how much he had summed me up, because once he got into the garage, he seemed pretty fascinated with stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, he was like, wow, there's a lot of stuff in here. So, I mean, the garage still functions as its mystical space.
Yeah.
So what was he really saying? I think that the choice and whoever made that choice with him to engage in our media universe was, I think he was baptizing the medium in a way. Mm-hmm. I mean, he could say, like, you're a big cheese now. I mean, maybe that's just because somebody, they talked me into coming here.
Right.
So you can't be nothing.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, maybe I'm not giving myself enough credit.
I think so.
Well, I think he listened to it, and I think he thought it was a good thing. It would be a good place for him to be candid and sort of relax a little bit. But I mean, I don't. What do you think? What would you suggest that I do in this idea of the more expansive me? Buy a Mercedes?
Oh God, no! I don't know what it would be. I don't know.
Does it have to do with structures, like a home?
I don't think it has to do with I don't think it has to do with some kind of specific material acquisition.
Because I'll tell you honestly that so then he couldn't know really what I really think about myself. The thing that is interesting is that my experience with him was the same experience I'm having with you. I didn't listen to that thing again, and I haven't even watched television since I talked to him.
Right.
I didn't engage in whatever became or whatever the media made of that interview. I mean, I did some media. I did a few local news things. I did some radio.
NPR.
I did, Terry Gross, right after. It was very selective. You know, my producer and I discussed things, and it was very selective. But somehow or another, I just detached from all of the momentum that happened outside of my experience with it. So my experience with that thing was the arrival, the leading up to, and then the sort of in the groove with the man himself, which was very, you know, visceral and intimate and right, like me and you right now. And it is all sort of mind blowing in retrospect, but I thought it was a good interview. It was a human experience.
It's a great interview.
I think we did all right.
But the I guess I see what you're doing there. I would hopefully do that too. I think you're de-emphasizing it. And why? I mean, what's the other option than to like walk around like constantly muttering to yourself?
Talk to the president.
Yeah.
Well, I did a little of that. And I think I'm still sort of blown away by it. I don't think the weight of it has really fully hit me. But, you know, like all the time working up to it, I was nervous because I needed to somehow have this experience with him and honor who he is and honor who I am and try to get some real, engagement. You know, I was not the guy to talk policy. It was not what we were going to do. I mean, the fact that we had to talk a bit about, you know, what was happening in the world because of tragedy and immediacy really steered that interview very quickly into a different place. And I think either of us necessarily were planning on going.
Did you, when you knew that you were getting this interview, did they tell you what you could or couldn't say? They didn't say anything.
Nothing. And they said we had control.
What are some questions
that
you were afraid to ask?
Well, the thing is that like I've talked to politicians before. I've talked to him before when he was a state senator when I was at Air America. I've talked to guys who do that job, politicians.
Yeah.
And the truth of the matter is, what anybody thinks about what needs to be said or what has to be said, this guy's, you know, politician's job is they're going to answer whatever question they want to answer.
Right.
Even if you ask a different one.
They're going to dodge it.
Well, yeah. Well, they're going to divert it.
Like when you called him middle management.
Yeah.
That was really good, man. That was really good.
Well, see, that was a good example of how was I going to accommodate some of the things I think about in terms of class and the idea of corporatization and corporate intrusion in government. How could I do that relatively quickly?
Oh.
Poetically, that where it would make sense and sort of land it. I mean, I thought that took balls to do that.
Yeah, it did.
And I knew that. I mean, I was like, I wonder if I can do this question. I wonder if he'll get it. Because I read his first book, The Dreams from My Father, and he gets it. He understands it. That was a pre-presidential hopeful. That was a guy, you know, wrestling with his own racial identity and with what he thought he needed to do in the world and, you know, wrestling with the sort of the path of an absent father that was a mythical presence in his life. So I read that. And what he understood about, you know, politics and how it worked from doing community organizing was really – he really understood it. He understood that. He understood how capitalism worked. He understood, you know, some of the compromises one has to make in order to get what they want to get done. But he's still operating at a fairly low level then in terms of just being a community organizer, you know. So I knew that. So I knew he would understand it, sort of what I was saying. But I think I might have garbled the question by keep talking.
It was too – I guess if anything, it was so subtle –
yeah.
That it it was an easy thing to dodge around.
Well, I think he sort of tried to address it and bring it back around. But you know, what became clear is that question became answered. I mean, he answered the question. The questions that I think that I did not ask that I would have liked to have asked is one would be because he mentioned drones, sort of like, oh, you know, I hear it all the time.
Yeah.
Like, there's a question I would have liked to ask that I couldn't do it, and which was, you know, when you're the president and there's that day that it comes where you got to make a decision where no matter what you decide, people are going to die.
Yeah.
So what's the weight of that? Because, you know, the answer around drones is, well, is there any sort of momentum or support to put American soldiers into harm's way if you can't really identify the reason as being a threat? At this juncture in history, can I sell that? Can I do that? Or do I just fly these fucking horrible things around and drop bombs, from nowhere?
Right.
Well, I mean, that's really the deliberation. I the idea that like, well, maybe we shouldn't have war. Well, yeah, that's idealistic.
Yeah.
But maybe you should, you know, frame what's really happening. Because there's this weird convoluted thing. Like I had this conversation with a guy who, like, I can't, what was it? It was out in front of a hotel. I just performed in Cleveland. And, you know, like, I don't talk about politics. And I'm not, I don't keep up as much. And I'm not as worked up as I used to be. It's not my wheelhouse.
Right.
And I'm fine with that. You know, it's okay. It's very divisive and it's very odd. You know, but like as I move away from the experience with the president, it's like my thing is that, look, I'm an American person. And, you know, I know we've all gotten cynical and empowered and we think that our voices are essential and important and we know better and we know things that are secret and mysterious and all these assumptions and we have all these things working. But the bottom line is cynical, no matter how cynical you are, what party you're on, or whether you don't believe in parties, or whatever the fuck you believe, the president asked to talk to me.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty fascinating. I mean, and I want to get to that, like what they must
But let me go back.
Okay.
Because I don't want to hijack your situation here on the paper. We'll get to it. But, you know, like my feeling and why I do the show I do is that I think that, you know, most people are troubled for real reasons. And a lot of them, most of them are personal and most of them are old. You know, most of them are you know, they're people are haunted by their wiring.
Yes.
I get that. And so, like, it was my belief for myself that I know that I use politics as a template to, you know, to sort of be angry through. Mm. Like, you know, what were my beliefs really? You know, and I've run the gamut of full lefty conspiracy, you know, and I sort of understand, you know, both sides of things.
Yes.
But it was not a sufficient explanation for why I felt the way I felt. And my heart was not necessarily in the place that I was assuming it was in through my anger. So I had to go some other way.
Oh, that's cool, man. So you recognize that that you were just using politics as a mirror to try to look at some part of yourself.
Or just to express anger without identifying really what the anger was.
I think that's a pretty popular affliction right now.
Of course. So what was interesting was, like, I was out in front of this hotel in Cleveland, and I just performed down the street. And there was several theaters in the complex I performed in. And Bill O'Reilly and Dennis Miller were doing a thing.
Yeah.
And I think I talked about the president with a little, but not specifically, because it was a very powerful conversation.
Yes.
You know, I sat next to this dude. He was probably 65, 70, and he was smoking a cigarette. And, you know, I was smoking a cigar, and I was sitting with Chris Garcia. And we just, you know, I said, "How you doing?" He said, "Well, I just over at the show." So I knew exactly where he was at. He went to see O'Reilly, and he went to see Dennis Miller. And he likes O'Reilly, and he said Dennis was doing some of the same jokes. He had seen him before. Mm. So I knew where he was politically, kind of.
Right.
But I didn't go in there. I didn't say, like, those guys. I didn't start a conversation from my side of the aisle,
right,
or whatever. You know what I mean? I just started to talk to him. You know, basically talk to him like I would talk to somebody I was interviewing. And, you know, he started complaining a little bit about Obama that, you know, we should have it was this weird sort of thing where he's like basically he was mad because it was convoluted. I'm just trying to think that you know, we pulled the troops out of Afghanistan, and there, I think it was, the element was like, you know, we didn't finish the job, and he was mad at Obama for not finishing the job, maybe. And but then he said, but no one could do it. No one could ever win. Like, it canceled itself out.
Right.
Like, you know, he had a practical understanding of the reality of the situation, but was, you know, sort of had been hijacked by right-wing talk.
Right.
You know, so and he was a veteran. He was in Vietnam, and he saw a guy get blown up. And, like, and he talked through all this stuff about how he still has nightmares and things. And, you know, we got all those places. But you know, people need a fucking demon, one side or the other. But the thing was, is that my point.
What do you mean people need a demon?
Look, you know, people demonize presidents.
Right.
Like, I did it to Bush.
Yeah, sure.
They're going to do it to Obama. I mean, you know, you want to hang the blame on somebody.
But isn't the inarguable demon, if you want to call it that, when you're sitting with Obama, you're probably sitting with someone who is directly or indirectly responsible for more death than anyone you've ever met in your life.
Yeah.
You're sitting with someone who's responsible for more death than any of our worst serial killers. You're sitting with someone who's responsible for extinguishing human lives all over the planet.
Yeah.
Whether they like it or not.
Right.
There's no president that I'm aware of who is not responsible
right.
for killing a shit ton of people.
Right.
So that's the crux of it, is that this person has reasons for killing people. He has reasons. Everyone has a reason for killing people.
Right. But yeah, but they're now, because you know, things, the reality of covert operations and the reality of the history of modern warfare, you know, at least, you know, post what, World War II, you know, Korea was probably kind of fucked up. But, you know, there was a time where there was a certain pride in killing.
Yeah.
And now it's become very abstract.
Right.
And you don't even know where it's really happening.
Right.
And the national agenda is not focused on, you know, we just killed a bunch of people. People would love to hear how many people in ISIS have been destroyed, but that
yes.
seems to be, you know, a tall order somehow to get those numbers.
We don't know the numbers, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but that's why I wanted to ask that question, because it was not relative to politics. I wanted to ask that question relative to his, you know, if you could call it, growth as a leader, or where his innocence died, or where, you know, the position of the most powerful politician in the world was, this weird baptism into that reality.
Yeah.
Where it's like, listen, President, I know it's your first day, but you gotta decide on how to kill a bunch of people.
That's it.
So I didn't get to that question.
How could you? It seems like...
I think you could. I could have asked it straight out, and I prepared to do it. because I was going to talk about, you know, how he evolved as a politician, and that decision, taking that responsibility, you know, having to handle that responsibility is part of that job. And I think I could have framed it just like that, and he would have said, well, it's a hard, you know, whatever he would have said.
Right.
But I could have asked it directly. It just, I ran out of time, and I wanted to make sure I had some, you know, levity in the thing. The other thing, you know, I wanted to, that was the one, you know, that got by me, because I thought it would have spoke a lot to how he weighed things morally and how he did sort of, because there was a transition in him at some point. You know, it's sort of like, it's like when you make your bones in the mafia, you know, it's how you become a made guy.
Yeah.
Something dies in you, has to. Right,
I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's a maybe it's a shift in definition. You know, maybe you've somehow like overcome the programming, if you want to call it that, that has made every single human life seem valuable to the majority of us, or we consider every single person to be valuable, to have just as much value and importance as any other person.
Yeah.
So maybe you start. Somehow you do the same thing for humans that a lot of people who eat meat do for cows, where you're like, well, they're just not quite of value. American lives are – I'm on Team America. I'm here to protect American lives. The equation goes like this. If I don't do this, this many American soldiers die and this many innocent, mm-hmm. you know, Afghani kids die. I'll always pick Afghani kids over American soldiers. That's always the decision I'm going to make as the president. That's what they think. And
I know,
that
but see, is it about soldiers, or is it about borders and boundaries and globalization and managing some sort of strange balance and trying to eliminate the threat to the established order? I don't think it's as jingoistic as the framework that you're like. I don't think it comes down to American soldiers anymore, because there's not, you know, it's not really what we're talking about.
I brought that up because when I was, you know, I've gone on a few very shrill drone rants and I've called Obama the drone lord, and I've really like found a lot of, like, you know, he made that joke about drones once where one of his daughters was dating, I don't remember, somebody, and he said one word, drones. And I remember thinking to myself, my God, man, what a distasteful joke to make in front of the country when those fucking things have been, I mean, I've seen the documentaries that show the carnage that happens because of those fucking
things. And it's not unlike when Bush jokingly looked for the WMDs.
Yes, that kind of like humor where if you know, I didn't find it funny, and I'm an American, but if somehow I was in another part of the country and my Aunt Jane had been exploded by the drone and I saw the president making a joke about them, I would just be like, oh, that's the Antichrist. That's clearly
something. Yeah, but it's not the Antichrist. It's just power. I mean, that's the weird thing, is that, you know, the sort of, you know, dark romanticization of end times nonsense.
Right.
It's fine. You know, you can define it however you want, but this part of humanity in some form or another has existed since two people decided they didn't like each other.
Yeah.
And some guy wanted that guy's stuff, whether it was fucking land or control of a bunch of women or control of a bunch of people.
Yeah.
I understand that, you know, technology and covert activity and mystery has shrouded this stuff, but this is power. And, you know, I mean, I don't even watch Game of Thrones, but I'm sure there's plenty of this same shit in there.
Oh, it's the essence of the show, is that every decision that you make, if you end up getting into a position of power, sucks. Like, there's no good decision. There's no easy decision. There's no black or and white decision. You end up killing people. It's just sucks. And when I say Antichrist, I don't think Obama.
No, I know that, but I think that there are some people that frame this like that. You know, even my weird father is susceptible towards a certain level of esoteric and sort of mystical apocalypto eschaton talk, you know.
Yeah, and it's eschaton talk is really fun, especially, you know, now it's really, I do have a conspiracy theory part of myself, so when I start seeing news stories popping up, I think, okay, this is probably nothing to be afraid of. Ebola, nothing to be afraid of. ISIS, nothing to be afraid of. But now the new news that's hitting is the brand new, or the resurrection of an old fear, which is thermonuclear war, mutually assured destruction between the United States and Russia. And I don't know if you saw the Vice documentary on it, but he went over there and interviewed a lot of high ups in Putin's administration. And they definitely aren't saying they wouldn't shoot missiles at us. They're not saying that that's not a possibility. And there's this rising realization that a lot of people are comparing the situation in Europe right now to pre-World War I conditions, and that, you know,
economy-wise,
and also the strange, there's weird alliance, there's too many scattered alliances, and something about NATO, like NATO has to attack Russia if they prove Russia is somehow actually engaged in the Ukraine, or if Russia somehow, some other thing happens. In Russia, they're saying, here's the situation. If somebody manages to fake Russia being involved in some conflict over there, if somebody pulled off making it seem like Putin really did this thing, then a new world war could possibly ensue. And it's just a very precarious predicament. Now, I don't know if this is just being painted this way by Vice or by people trying to make juicy, cool news stories, but it's a brand new fear. So talking about the apocalypse, right?
Is it
now
a brand new fear?
Well, for us, for millennials.
I don't know. You know, they, like, for a while there, the fear was that you know, who's in charge of those Russian nukes?
But you never did a, I mean, maybe you did. As far as I recall, I never did a nuclear attack drill, which they used to do in schools. That was a normal thing. People had bomb shelters.
There isn't one anymore.
Right. Right, and that was the other creepy thing. I can't remember where I read this article. The other creepy thing was
the irony of those drills was that no one would live.
Right. It was just trying to comfort you. It's like in the plane when they tell you what to do with the seat or all that shit to make you feel like you're going to
I think that there was that somebody thought, depending on where you were from, you know, the impact from ground zero, that you know, that on the outside of it, outside of the radius, you know, maybe getting under the desk would stop some immediate carnage from something falling on you. But, you know, within days, the radiation sickness
would
level
everything. It's going to eat you alive.
Everything. So, yeah, I know that. Here's the question to you then.
Okay.
Given that, okay, you have this new possibility, this new reality, this brand new framing of an age-old fear of mass destruction. Okay. What can you do about it right now?
Oh, right. Well, that is the only question anyone should ask, because clearly the answer to that, or at least my answer to that, is the advice I get from the Ram Dass people, which is we work on ourselves so we can help the people closest to us. And I think that that's really great advice. And for me, that's what it inevitably boils down to.
But feel the energy of you describing your new fear. I mean, like, you know.
Okay,
You lit up.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so that's good, Mark. That's good. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a blast, man. Yeah. It's exciting, you know. Oh, God. Like, I can remember a particular mushroom trip laying again, like curled up against the wall of my dorm room, and my eyes are shut, and I'm just seeing the bombs and thinking, my Christ, they're actually fanatics in other parts of the world that would love to incinerate us. And there's something so thrilling about that in a real pleasurable, enjoyable way, just because it's a fantasy and because, you know, most of us have not experienced war in the traditional way that so many generations experience war. Like, we haven't really, really experienced, you know, a world war. We didn't know, like, fucking Hitler was possibly going to take over the planet. Like, that was a possibility. Like, that you were in London and you were getting bombed. Like,
yeah.
London.
No, it's crazy. No, absolutely. I agree with that. I just, like, you know, and I'm sort of, I've become a sucker on the other side of things. You know, I'm less of a sucker for apocalypse and more of a sucker for wanting to believe people are okay.
Right.
You know, I don't know when that, I think it's probably always been in me, but I can be, you know, duped, and I can be, you know, I'm always surprised when I hear things about people that I know that are revealed to be like horrible things. And I'm like, what? But I thought we were friends. I had no idea you had all these people in your basement. So I have to reckon with that. I don't know what to really do with that, you know. And like, even when talking to the president, like, I understood all these things that you're saying, and I understood them for myself in some ways as well. I don't frame them exactly the same way you do, or experience the type of fury or panic around the ideas that you do, but I still felt the need to sort of ask him some practical questions and some human questions.
Sure.
You know, like, the other question I wanted to ask is, like, do you know everything that you're in charge of?
That's a good one, man. Yeah.
You know, like, because, like, you know, I have to assume, like, I can barely keep my life together, and it's small.
Yeah.
So I have to assume there are things going on that he's delegated. And, I mean, that's part of the way the government works.
Right.
And that, you know, I'm sure he's briefed on stuff, but it'd be nice to, you know, that would be a good question with the sort of list of things.
That's a great question. Just the basic logistics of being a president. Like, how do you keep track? Do you keep track of hours? Is there someone watching over you? Do you clock in? Is there a time card?
No, but just sort of like, you know, like, there's a lot of stuff going on in the world that he needs to know about on a daily basis. And he has, you know, trusted aides, and there's a structure in place that, you know, things that are, you know, there's just a level. It's like, you know, there's got to be a lot of noise that, you know, he doesn't need to know about. When that noise becomes, it's sort of like President Bush, you know, getting an actual public daily briefing that says, you know, Osama bin Laden will attack with airplanes. And somehow he just didn't register that.
And the other curious thing to me with him is, like, he's just got to have, like, normal friends, right? He's got to have at least a couple of guys he talks
to. Who, Barack?
Yeah.
The president?
Yeah.
I would think so. I mean, I think they have confidence.
People who call him at night and just talk about, like, their marriage or just...
I don't know. Yeah, maybe. I mean, you would hope so. I think he's very close to his wife.
Because the you know, they talk about this presidential bubble that you're in, which you have to be in, where not just
enforced.
It's enforced
relatively well, unless someone wants to get into the
White House. You're like a rare creature you're like one of those rhinos that's constantly followed around by a caravan of jeeps to keep it from getting killed. That's what the president's like. They had to just close your fucking neighborhood down.
Right, yeah. And it's also like it serves, there is a protocol to it. But, you know, the president also has a very symbolic job of being a figurehead. And I think that one of the interesting things of being the symbol for the country, the leader of the country.
Yeah.
You know, that's part of the job, to appear that way. I don't think that's an easy trick. You know, because, like, I think that one of the things that happened with the podcast was, you know, people, I think a lot of people on both sides, for whatever reason, you know, one side maybe more hate and the other side more disappointment. But they, you know, they just stopped really registering that guy a few years ago.
Right.
You know, like, the, you know, one side is like, hate him. And right. You know, they hang the, you know, they would blame him for everything. And then the other side is sort of like, no, I kind of hope for more. You know, that, so, and so they kind of, like, detach from him. And I think one of the interesting things about the podcast was that people, I saw people tweeting about it, like, I forgot why I love this guy.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, and even people that don't like him, they're like, I don't really like him, but that was great talk. You know, like, it's like, it's just the human guy.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's also one of the, obviously, he's like the ultimate alpha male of our country. Like, that is
supposed to be.
That is the fountainhead of charisma as far as politics go.
But I find him to be very thoughtful and reserved in a way that is not, like, he's not the guy you're like, I gotta have a beer with that guy.
Oh, man. When I was listening to him, I was like, you know, 6 minutes into that, not even that, 3 minutes into the interview, yeah. I'm like, I fucking love this guy.
Yeah.
But then I keep thinking about the body count, and I keep going back to the body count, and that makes his affability, that makes his charisma, that makes the thing that in one of your interviews you talked about how he put you at ease so quickly, that makes all of that so incredibly sinister. Because as far as I'm aware of, the most charismatic serial killer that I think you could say would be Ted Bundy, right? All the other ones, Gacy, who's the Zodiac killer, those guys are pretty they're too wonky, they're too quirky, but fucking Barack Obama, he's got a much larger kill count than
those. But like, I don't know about that framing. It's okay. I mean, I understand what you're saying.
How
murder
is it? It's
well,
not
I mean, murder is murder. I mean, yeah. I understand that. But you know, if you were to ask, if you were to say to John Wayne Gacy or you were to say to Ted Bundy, so why do you kill people?
Yeah.
What answer would you get?
Well, it just depends, you know.
But fine. Is it connected to any sort of, you know, ideological necessity that has, you know, sort of a certain amount of other people's interests in the balance?
Well, one of my friends has this great line in one of his songs, which is, if I was ever going to do anything, especially some horrible deed, I wouldn't want to do it for any reason because the reason would dilute the act. It's better to...
Okay, so fine. So there's your serial killer. Maybe it's an undiluted act of what they need to get off. I don't think that leaders and people in power, unless, you know, they... You can, unless there might be an element of it, but there are other things in the balance. I mean, there's other forces at work. Now, you can disagree with those forces and you can say, like, well, we've got to figure out how to resolve this shit because too many people are dying. There's still something to be resolved.
Job description. You will save the economy. You will be one of the forces behind gay marriage becoming legal in the United States. You will kill 60 children.
And you will get everyone the possibility of health care.
Right. That too. You, which I'm very grateful for. As someone who has cancer, that's a big deal for me that they don't like that you could, because they used to, investigate you. Anyway, all those things are wonderful. But still, the job description, you're going to get to this line. Wait, the 60 children. I'm going to kill 60.
Okay, but so, okay. Yeah, maybe by 60 people by, you know, there's no explaining that other than that you're right. It's part of the job.
It's part of the job. And so you make a decision. You're like, yes, I'll take the job. And so now the weird, creepy thing, I know you're going to say this is like bullshit.
No.
But the weird, creepy thing is, what's the diff? Like, if I came to you, if I'm a witch mm-hmm. and I come to you and I say, you can save this country. All we need to do is sacrifice 60 children
mm-hmm.
for the country.
Mm-hmm.
We must feed 60 children to the dragon because the dragon's angry, mm-hmm. 60 children to the mountain. Mm-hmm. And you're like, yeah, go ahead, kill the children.
I don't know.
What does that make you?
But did he save the country? I mean, is that really the balance? I mean, is that really the
I think
nuance?
He did some great things for the country.
I know, but I don't think those great things you mentioned were necessarily directly related to him sacrificing children.
Oh, no, but he did. I mean, it was part of the. It's part of the job.
I understand. It's part of a cop job to possibly kill people, and sometimes wrongly.
Possibly,
you're right. It's part
in italics. President, no, possibly you're gonna kill. Mm-hmm. That's all. Mm-hmm. It's just a weird decision to make. We're like, yeah, sure.
But what? But can we say leader? As a leader of a modern civilized country,
yeah.
That you know there are going to be forces at work that are going to require. Murderous action.
Well, I mean, he did compare, like he does, like when he with his when he talks about guns, he does compare. He does talk about any other advanced country. They have like stricter gun laws, or people can't even have guns. But when I don't know, like, I don't know who runs Sweden, but whenever I think of an advanced country, I guess that's the one I think of. But I bet that person doesn't have 60 dead kids in his closet. You know, when I think about other right. countries, you know, so there is a difference. And man, the
But it's also a matter of, like, you know, the relative power.
Right. Well, this is if you were. Let's just say.
I think it's hard to make. Go ahead. I'm not defending.
Let's say we're running. We're part of a country where I don't know what part of the economy is the military, but do you know what part of the economy is the military in the United States? It's a big part of the economy, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. He was saying healthcare.
The military
is one,
industrial complex.
Yeah, exactly. Like he was saying, healthcare is like 1/6 of the economy. Mm-hmm. Then the military must be some other. I don't know what it is, what aspect of the economy it is, but if you're
how much it costs the taxpayer to, you know, to get the military, keep it fed,
yeah, right,
with the machines of war,
yeah, and the manufacturing and mm-hmm. all the jobs that
it's
go
big,
into manufacturing,
it's always been
it's really,
big.
Really big.
Yeah.
So if you're running a thing where a big part of the engine, one of the cylinders, is based on manufacturing weapons to blow people up, mm-hmm. and it's a huge part of it, mm-hmm. then you would definitely want the citizens to think that a necessary part of being powerful is killing people. You would want people to think it's just.
Well, no, but it's like, right, but it's in the guise of protecting.
Right. Yeah. Right.
No, I understand these things. And I do agree. It is part of that guy's job. And it, you know, how do you dismantle that? People have been trying to figure that out for years. I mean, wasn't it Eisenhower that, you know, gave
yes.
the warning
yes.
about the military-industrial complex yeah. and the need for it to be fed?
Yeah.
I've used my metaphors in the past in my act. I know that monster. I know that Satan. And
yeah.
is this guy that I talked to, the guy who was, you know, sitting with the control of that, I think to a certain degree. But see, that's about the question of how much, you know, how much do you really know what's going on? Like, you know, I
yeah.
know you're briefed on stuff, but I mean, if you listen to Eisenhower, he said that, you know, who is really going to be in charge?
Yeah.
Ultimately, that's what you have to be afraid of.
Right.
Who can't you say no to?
Right.
You know, those are good questions. Maybe you should interview the president.
I would love to, man. And not to like suddenly just go to like the most shallow level ever, man. But I want to ask you this, and it's a serious question.
Yeah.
What did he smell like?
I don't remember if I registered it. I remember like touching him, you know, and he put his arm around me and stuff. And it was just, you know, he was lean, you know, and
yeah.
he was a tall guy.
Yeah.
Like he drank some tea while he was talking to me.
Who made the tea?
They travel with somebody.
Oh, wow.
They have I don't think it's a food taster, but it might kind of. You know, they travel with it's an in-house caterer. They have, you know, a woman who brought him his tea.
God, I wish you'd ask for a sip of that tea or a glass of the tea to see what he's drinking.
It was black tea. He left the cup.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
That's so cool. Man, look, aside from all my, like, you know, ranting, conspiracy stuff, I think I would have cried too, man. I heard an interview that you cried. I think the outburst of energy
yeah.
from being around a being of, you know, with that much power, and it is power, and I'm not saying it's like real power, but it's definitely, he's imbued with the power.
He's a lot more down to earth than I thought.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I've seen a couple of other presidents. They're weird things, presidents.
They are. They're strange creatures.
Well, they don't register like even when Bill Clinton was, you know, caught up in the sex scandal and Bush was doing all his evil, I had a hard time really attributing any sexuality almost to these men.
Right.
You know, and I don't know if that's some sort of weird wired in, you know, respect for the, you know, for the
yeah.
office or something we were brought up with. But like, you know, with Obama, they're, you know, they operate at a frequency that is, it's highly managed from within. And it's whatever their weird gift is,
right?
Or curse, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, they have to stay, you know, hold strong. You know, there's got to be something about that. There's something in is it word I want, impervious or impenetrable? There's something
yeah.
impenetrable
yeah.
because there's a lot of layers of stuff. And like, and I really think that even if you asked him what you're talking about, like, you're a killer, man. I mean, how do you live with yourself knowing that there are 60 children dead? Like,
yeah.
they might as well be in bed with you, man.
Yeah.
So like, I imagine he'd be very, you know, kind of diplomatic and say, like, I understand what you're saying. It's a tough job. decisions have to be made,
right,
where accidents happen.
Yeah.
And you can't control. Yeah, I mean, like, I don't think he'd say that you're full of shit.
No, I don't think he would either. I think he couldn't, because it's true. He just has to admit the fact that he's driving a bus that every once in a while runs over a kid. And because the bus is supposed to be going, he's got to keep driving it. There's just no way out of it. You know,
look, obviously, when human life is lost, it's awful. Especially
best bus on earth.
Especially, I didn't hear that kind of stuff. I mean, I didn't hear any insane sort of like jingoistic rationalizations from that guy.
Right.
I didn't put him in a position to really use them. You know what I heard, and what really resonated with me, outside of getting hung up on the darkness, which is real, was that, you know, the democratic process, what's left of it, which isn't much, is move slowly, and it moves too slow for most people's, childish need for closure and progress. Like, you know, for him to say that growth is incremental, and for a guy to, you know, say, who has been, you know, had given just nothing but obstacles by the rest of the Republican side of the government, like literally, like, just say no to everything. Even if it's good for people, saying
right.
No. And this is a guy that, you know, wants to do good. I believe that's true. And, you know, he has to navigate with the military-industrial complex,
yep,
with corporate interests, with globalization,
yep,
you know, and make weird decisions that are going to piss a lot of people off. It might not be the right decisions, but, you know, for the people, the stuff he has tried to do for the people and actually got done is pretty good shit. So, but for him to, you know, like, it really never really made sense to me as much as this, is that we all expect, because of, like, you know, like, I'm sitting here, like, you know, I could, you know, I got a lot of things going on.
Yeah.
I'm getting texts. You know, I have access to things very quickly.
Yeah.
I can get whatever I want almost overnight. There's this expectation. It's like, why didn't this guy change everything? Well, what do you want, a unilateral leader?
No,
do you,
man,
want a king?
You're right.
So the weird thing for him to sort of, like, when I just straight up said, you know, how do you remain hopeful given the situation? It's like, well, if I can wake up in the morning and feel like I've, you know, moved the country into a better direction at all, 2%.
Yeah.
I've done something. Because that's the pace. I mean, it might work faster if there was more sort of, like, less polarization, but there isn't.
No, to me, that was what I got out of that interview. That was, I love having my lazy tendency to turn everything into a black or white situation. I love having that fucked up. And definitely that interview did that for me.
Mm-hmm.
It did scramble that a little bit. It did, you know, and the other thing I really loved is you just see how he's figured out how to look underneath people's opinions of him to something deeper inside of them, or at least that's what he was saying. I thought that was really
right.
Beautiful. But let me tell you what I thought was the most beautiful part of that interview. Man, I am so, and I will eternally be impressed by your decision to wear a flannel. I thought that was one of the coolest fucking things I'd ever seen.
Plaid Western shirt?
Oh, my God. That's what it was, a plaid Western shirt. But it's... was there a moment at all where you're like, I'm going to wear a suit? Did you think about, consider that?
I don't really, it didn't make sense to me. Do you know what I mean? I mean, you know, he's coming to my house. You know, he didn't wear a jacket. I mean, I didn't think about wearing a suit, but I was like, well, what am I going to wear for the present? I'm like, well, I'm going to dress like I dress every day because, you know, I'm going to work. So.
Yeah, that's cool, man. That's integrity, man. Because really, it's like, when I heard you're doing the interview, that was one of the first things that popped into my head is, what the fuck is he going to wear, man? Like, I think I would wear a suit. I think I would, like, go. I'd freak out. I'd spend a week going to, like, get a suit fitting.
Yeah.
I would hear my parents in my head, like, it's the president, Duncan. Uh-huh. You can't wear a T-shirt in front of the president. But that, to me, embodied podcasting. That was the aesthetic of it. You didn't change the aesthetic at all. I thought that was pretty cool, man.
The weird thing, like, honestly, going in, dude, you know, it's like, I knew it was a big deal. But in my mind, having my experience in doing some political talk radio and talking to politicians, I knew he is the president. And there's something innately awesome about having the opportunity to talk to a president. But I also knew he was a guy that
right.
came up through a certain, you know, bunch of, like, weird obstacles, you know, to get to where he is. There was some balances that had to be made. He came up through politics. He came up through community activism. He knows, like, he's the pro. He's, you know, he's the best one, right? You know, he's the best one at it. So in my mind, you know, I knew that, you know, I was, you know, serving a purpose. And I knew that, you know, there was something that he was serving in me too, that this was an exciting event for what we do. And it was an exciting event for me personally.
Yeah.
And it was a challenge because, you know, he sought me out for what I do. So I have to do what I do. I have to do what I do as best I can with this amazingly challenging guest. But my only thought was like, I knew in my mind and in my heart, I was like, you know, you might not get anything.
Right.
You know, so like the things that you should try to avoid is not getting him into the weeds in a wonky way, because, you know, he's very deliberate and he's very long winded and it could, you know, could eat up a lot of time.
Right.
So there were moments in my head where I was like, all right, we got to shift. You know, like I knew that. And I even finished his sentences a couple of times. I mean, what the fuck is wrong with me? You know, like I'm calling him man and I'm throwing words in when he's like, you know, like stumped on a word because I do that. So, like, it got to a point where I was able to do that, and I didn't have a head full of what you have, which I think would have caused me a tremendous amount of fear, and it would have caused me, like, a weirdness. Like, I tried to think about how to frame questions that would encompass some of the stuff that we're talking about here, you know, without it being insulting.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean,
I wanted to be respectful.
Well,
he's the president.
I know. And no,
I didn't wear a suit, but
listen,
I wanted her.
Please don't. I hope I don't seem accusatory. Like, why wouldn't you ask him about the dead kids? Because I think I would have just turned into a stammering, weeping bit of jelly. You know, I think you did an incredible job. It's just, I wonder what he would have said. And I wonder if maybe presidents are going to start being on podcasts all the time now, if that's just going to be a normal thing. And that sort of takes me to my last question for you, which is, what do you think is the future of this medium? Like, where do you see this going?
Well, look, it is what it is. It's obviously relevant, you know, some of them, you know what I mean?
Right, yeah.
And you know, you got to decide what you want to let into your world. You know, I was asked a fairly, you know, the only intelligent question that I was asked during the post thing, outside of like, oh, the N-word, huh? I'm like, I don't know what you're getting hung up on. I'm a comedian.
Right.
You know, we've discussed that word and others for a long time. And, you know, he was saying it to talk about using it. He wasn't, it's like, I mean, it's,
right.
Whatever. So I didn't get caught up in that. But the one relevant question that someone asked me, he said, well, are you going to become like the Larry King of this campaign? Are you going to run the candidates through?
Wow.
And I'm like, no, I have no desire to get involved in politics again. I was afforded an opportunity, the honor, really, to talk to the sitting president at my house.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And so the guy goes, so you wouldn't have Hillary on? And I'm like, no, when she's president. I'll have her on.
Oh, come on. If Hillary Clinton's people, you would not have her on.
I can't do it because I don't want to be that guy. See, that's the thing. I don't want to be back in that world.
Yeah.
I got an opportunity to talk to the president. I don't want to talk to people trying to be president.
Wow.
That to me was the only relative question. And it was a smart question. So does that mean that Hillary's going to go do the Nerdist? Sure, maybe.
Right.
You know, but I can't, like, I like they're tricky to talk to, and you're not going to make either side happy. And for some reason, the conversation I had with that guy got very little flack from both sides, because I think there was something about it. It was so surprisingly candid and so in tone. There's something about audio, and there's something about just being focused on the guy talking to a regular Joe like me for an hour, where it's sort of like, what is happening?
Yeah.
You know. And I think there were moments that were really sort of revealing in a weird way. You know, he's going to talk about what he talks about, but he'd never talked about it with a guy in his garage before.
No.
So that's really what it comes down to, is I need to protect, you know what I do, and I think the future for podcasts in relation to that, look, politicians will, you know, in general will use whatever will work.
Right. And Hillary Clinton, you're not listening, but I would have you on in a second. I'd love to talk with you. It'd be so fun. Mark, thank you, man. Thanks for coming over and doing this. I know you're the busiest
guy. Here's the problem is that, like, you know, in 6 months, you know, the day after I've had Hillary on.
Yeah, right. Marin, you
liar, you!
No, no one's going to
no
do
integrity.
That.
No integrity.
No, it's the what is no, it? What I, is it? Gandhi I, says the most important thing is truth, not consistency.
That's interesting. But like, I just, it's not part of my plan to become part of the political dialogue. I like doing the way I do it.
Yeah, man. But you know what? It's pretty cool to have somebody like you getting a chance to talk to these people. It's important. And maybe even though you don't want to be part of the political dialogue, you should reconsider. Just because
really?
It's cool, man.
Is it my responsibility?
Maybe a little. Yeah, maybe so. If it's coming to you, it's pretty cool. It's like a good thing. It's a way for...
But then I have to go, but I have to do both sides.
I don't think you have to do anything because it's
no, but
podcast.
Like if you do, like I know that, but then like see the thing is that I talk to the president,
yeah.
Okay, and he's the president of everybody, whether you like it or not.
Right,
he's the president of the United States of America, the United States of America, no matter how off the fucking grid you are.
Yes,
if you're occupying some territory, and it's just an outhouse and a tent, and if it's in the United States, he's your fucking president.
Yep.
So that's an amazing thing. So if I start talking to people who are running for president, and I only talk to, you know, the people I'm sympathetic with, then all of a sudden it's like, this fucking guy.
Right.
We don't want to be that guy. What do I want to be in that position for again? I
know
what that
is. Yeah, you get to do that, though. I don't know. I understand
we'll
what
see.
You're saying.
We'll see. I'll leave it at that.
Mark Maron, you guys know his podcast, WTF. Thank you so much, Mark.
Love you, man.
Love you, too. That was the beautiful Mark Maron, everybody. If you enjoyed this podcast, won't you subscribe to us on iTunes? Bookmark our Amazon site. Listen to WTF. And, definitely support Squarespace. Remember, if you use offer code Duncan, you'll get 10% off your first order. Hope you guys have a great week. I'll see you real soon. Hare Krishna.